Hey, so I said Hrishikesh Hirway was going to be on the show this week. That's actually going to be next week. Things change sometimes. So this week, I'm going to talk to you for a while about me and depression and road rage and trucks and doctors. Then I'm going to talk to somebody else about therapy and Dungeons and Dragons. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. My book, The Hilarious World of Depression, is available now in paperback, where books are sold. The book has received a lot of great reviews. Publishers Weekly starred review, The New York Times liked it, The Today Show. Most importantly, a lot of people have written to me saying that this book has helped them on their own mental health journey. The Hilarious World of Depression is a memoir of where mental health developments intersected with the life I was living. Some of these stories are very painful. Some are pretty funny. A lot of them are somewhere in the middle, and both. I'm really familiar with these stories, both from having written them for the book and, you know, from living them. And there are parts that I read a lot at bookstore events when the hardcover came out. But I asked our Facebook listener group, the Preshies, what they wanted to hear read aloud. And one section kind of emerged as a really popular choice. Katrina said, taking your truck, the Grape Ape, to the dump and running into a couple of bros with shiny new trucks. That was one of my first sincere belly laughs in a very long time. People jumped in to agree. Tom said, same, because there were so many times my depression manifested in anger and I had no idea what was going on with me. John captured exactly how I felt before I knew what the hell was up or down with me. Amy said, yes, also the rage and fear for what he was maybe capable of was completely, unfortunately, relatable. So this is a story of confronting some of the effects of depression and doing something about them, eventually. The Jill referenced in this section is my wife. We're living in Seattle when this story takes place. Chapter 7, in which I am told that, yeah, there's something wrong. In late 2000, a human emerged from Jill's body, a boy named Charlie. 2 years later, there was another human, this one a girl named Kate. Though quite tiny, these babies required a ton of stuff. Cribs, beds, dressers, strollers, and so very many toys. Lots of noisy electronic toys, too, all of which were given to us by friends and family. No sane person would ever buy a noisy toy to have in their own house. Hell, I was insane, and I still wasn't buying them. Kate was born with achondroplasia, the most common form of dwarfism, which entailed a lot of medical issues and uncertainty about the future. She arrived at the same time the radio show I worked on was being canceled, and even though I managed to hold on to a job at the station, my professional and financial future became quite shaky. So it was time for therapist number 5. A small, earnest woman working out of a small, earnest office with small, earnest macrame hangings on the walls. It was a relationship that might have worked out better had I been more committed to it, but I was in panicked survival mode and couldn't really open up. Instead, just repeating the mantra, I'm strong, I'm going to be fine, I will win. Over and over again, which is not actually any kind of therapy at all. When Kate's health stabilized and the job crisis wound down, I cut number 5 loose. The stress and sleep deprivation of parenting were tough, and so was living in a house overflowing with stuff. An innocent walk across the living room could result in tripping on some weird Elmo manifestation that then laughed, not helping matters. So, equipped with the Grape Ape, I began regular runs to Goodwill donation boxes and, for things they would not take, the dump. The South Transfer Station is located on South Kenyon Street in the lower tendrils of the Seattle city limits. Navigating that part of town can be tricky because it's basically an estuary, the Duwamish Waterway, so you'll be looking for somewhere and run across a river or swamp with no clear idea how to get around it. Large highways are sometimes a help, but just as likely to take you far out of your way, farther from the target than you had been before, and in worst cases, to my hometown. Finding the dump the first few times out was difficult, and I would become increasingly angry, as had been my tendency behind the wheel lately. "Fuck!" I would scream at a stop sign, which would not respond. And at that point, contrary to the stop sign's instructions, I could not stop a chain of thoughts that whipped up in a hurry. It went like this. I was lost, therefore I was lazy and hadn't planned my trip, and therefore the trip would take me longer than expected, and therefore I was a bad husband and father because I was neglecting my family. This series of increasingly terrible thoughts took only a few seconds. Eventually, I got the hang of it and could drive to the dump without rage attacks. On a March morning, a Saturday, I loaded up the Ape and took the smooth path to South Kenyon Street and joined an exceptionally lengthy queue of vehicles. I was listening to the radio, which held a decreasing amount of interest for me, despite my being employed in the radio industry. Or I could listen to CDs, though music had likewise become steadily less interesting over the past several months. Finally, I turned all sound off and sat there, staring straight ahead. That silent idleness served as an invitation to my frequent visitors' agitation and negative thinking, who happily rushed in. I was angry that there were other people in line in front of me. I hated them. I wanted to get out of the truck, open their doors, drag them out, and beat the shit out of them. Yes, yes, I thought, this is a new reaction, and an alarming one, a more virulent strain of my road rage incident while working at Amazon, now with a greater threat of violence. Looking at the vehicles in front of me, it occurred to me how much nicer most of them were than the Ape. A few beaten down trucks here and there, sure, but also brand new, sparkling clean Ford F-Series trucks in white. White! Who is prosperous and organized and tidy enough to own a white truck? There were Range Rovers, presumably driven by rich people who were casually consigning to oblivion pricey items that a lot of people would love to own. Expeditions, Highlanders, Escalades, the kinds of multisyllabic land yachts driven by people who moved to Seattle from somewhere else and then made a lot more money than I did. Those fuckers, began my internal monologue. They are in my way in every sense. Clogging up the highways so you can't even get around in Seattle anymore. Can't see around those fucking cars because they're too big. Driving the cost of living sky high, trampling out any charming eccentricities this city once had. Fuck them. That's right. To pass the time, I seethed. Even undiagnosed depressives have hobbies. And look at me, I went on in my mind. I'm in a truck called the Grape Ape with dings and scrapes all over it from 19 way too long ago. It's the worst looking thing in any given Seattle parking lot, but it's all I can afford. I'm shackled to the house because of that mortgage. Can't ever move because even though our house is worth more than it was, I'd have to buy another house in Seattle and I can't afford that. So I'm stuck in that place. Or we'll move out to the suburbs where I grew up, which would mean I'm a failure, as I already know. I'm shackled to the kids because they're kids, and it's not fair to them because I'm a horrible dad. And I'm shackled to the job that I have because I'm stupid and worthless, so no other employer will have me. At the South Transfer Station, I backed into my spot and began hurling my detritus from the Ape's bed. The anger was still there. You know how when you get mad, you get this warped idea that throwing something across the room will purge those feelings? And you know how that never ever works and you don't feel better? As I hurled away, a new bright red Chevy Silverado truck containing two rich guys pulled up. How do I know they were rich guys? Couldn't they be working class despite their polo shirts, cargo shorts, and backwards baseball caps? No, I had already judged them. They were rich guys in a truck that cost 10 times what mine did. I hated them before they even got out, and all the personal details I will share about them come entirely from my imagination. While Scott, with one T, climbed out of the driver's side, Brett, with one T, swung the passenger door open, dinging the Ape's door in the process. Brett immediately inspected his own door for damage, ignoring mine. "Hey," I said. "Careful." "Sorry, man," said Brett, with no remorse. "Because what do other people matter to Brett? He's a date rapist." I glared some more. They didn't notice. And we all set about discarding things from our truck beds. Of course, Scott and Brett moved faster because they had each other, because they had the ability to make friends, unlike me. And they were young and strong, whereas I was getting old and too lazy to exercise much because I'm a bad person. They worked at an investment firm and used the nickname Dog for everyone. They beat their actual dogs. I could tell. Nearing completion of our parallel jobs, Scott let slip a piece of perfectly good shelving, which fell out of his hands off the side of the Silverado and hit the side of the Ape, scratching the door. Scott then picked it up, mumbled, "Whoa, sorry," and threw the piece in the pit. "Sorry?" I said. And here came the red curtain over my eyes. Anger, temper, rage. "You dropped something on my truck and you just say sorry? What the fuck?" "I'm sorry," he said in that perplexed way privileged people talk when they're confronted with the concept of taking responsibility for their actions. "You can't even tell." Scott, a Limp Bizkit fan, was right. The shelving had absolutely dented or scratched the side panel, but so had a lot of other things, starting way before I owned the Ape. It was one of these marks, but I couldn't tell which one. If I had dropped something similar on the Silverado, it would have been obvious and I would have had to tell my insurance company and my rates would have gone up. But Scott and Brett would not suffer any such consequences. It sucked. "This sucks," I said. They looked over, but said nothing. "This sucks," I then hollered, unnerving Scott and Brett, who had completed their task and were getting back in the truck. This warped, semi-blinding emotion began as a mix of class resentment and envy, but by the third, "this sucks," and the subsequent, "this sucks," close on its heels, it existed as rage for the sake of rage. It felt very similar to when I was 16 years old, angrily yelling at my father, at first because of his smoking and drinking, but finally I was yelling because I was yelling and I could not stop. The rage having overridden all the controls, spurred on by the futility of my actions. I imagine I looked crazed to Brett and Scott, who once played for their fraternity house's intramural lacrosse team and now smirked through mandatory sexual harassment training. I was crazed. The Ape's bed was empty, and I tried to let the whole experience go. Another car slipped in between the departing Silverado and Ape, which was a relief. And an annoyance. An annoyance because I wanted to harass the bros from one car back, and a relief because I was unable to. There were two checkout lanes, and the car between us unexpectedly stayed in line behind the Silverado, despite the other lane being open. So I pulled up there. I got weighed, paid, and left, to find the Silverado pulling out right in front of me. "Let it go, let it go, let it go, let it go. Yeah, but fuck those assholes," went my reasoning, followed by a long honk from the Ape's loud horn. Scott and Brett looked back, saw it was me, and kept going, figuring I just needed to get it out of my system. My system was just getting started. The glance back enraged me more, since it was easy to fit into my narrative of everything wrong with Seattle and, by the way, America. So I honked some more loudly and repeatedly as we continued down Fifth Avenue to the big intersection at South Cloverdale Street. This was where I needed to turn right, up the hill, back to my house, and so I signaled right. The Silverado signaled left. I stopped honking. I pulled up behind them and lowered the driver's side sun visor to obscure my face. The dump rage was now officially road rage. But it had shifted from being all yelly and screamy to something much deeper. Had Scott and Brett actually gotten out and walked back to confront me, chances are I'd either have sped off or, if that was impossible, locked the doors and cowered inside. But then again, maybe I wouldn't have. Seething in the Ape, I daydreamed about beating the crap out of both guys. Or maybe I could be so crazed and violent that Scott and Brett, drunk by 10 a.m. during college football season, wearing athletic sandals, would run away and I would be the de facto winner. They looked back at me, apprehensive, but not confrontational. They were scared. This was great. A moment here. Boy, I spin thoughts around in my head a lot, don't I? Like, a lot. Well, that's what depression does. The dance floor of your mind is never without a pounding beat, and usually the DJ is playing 8 or 9 songs at the same time. Okay, the Silverado turned left. I followed and did the same. In 1971's Duel, Steven Spielberg's directorial debut, a regular driver, played by Dennis Weaver, is relentlessly harassed and pursued by the driver of an oil tanker truck. The chase is made all the more terrifying by the fact that you never see the truck driver's face. Scott and Brett were Dennis Weaver. I was the unseen driver, and the poor ape, who never asked to be part of this, was cast as the tanker truck. I wanted Scott and Brett to wonder what I was going to do. I wanted them to worry. What I really wanted was to transfer what I was feeling more and more in my life over to them. All the negativity and worry, I wanted that on their heads. I wanted to be understood. The Silverado was making frequent turns down residential streets, hoping, I think, that I would stick to the arterials and drive away. I stayed behind them, not tailgating, but certainly following, absolutely looming. I wanted someone to get hurt. Me, them, it mattered less and less. After a few minutes of this, my heart slowed down, I stopped seeing red, and I regained enough real estate in my own brain to think for a second about what happens next. Would they eventually lose me on the freeway, but write down my license plate, sending the cops to my house to talk to or arrest me, leaving Jill to watch it all go down? That would be a pretty logical move on their part. I started constructing a defense in my head. Gosh, officer, is it illegal to drive down streets in our city? I didn't threaten them or anything. Sure, they damaged my truck at the dump, but I let it go because I don't like to start any trouble. Still, though, Jill would be thinking, what the hell, now we have cops at the door? Finally, at yet another residential intersection, I swerved the opposite direction from the Silverado and drove away. I headed home. I tried to imagine how this pattern would end. Not today, not even this year, but sometime after the 5th road rage episode, or the 10th, or the fight, or me getting shot at, or genuinely shot, and not by a BB gun. And it came down to 2 possible outcomes. Legal trouble with no one getting hurt, or legal trouble with someone getting hurt. There was no scenario I could pull up where I was less angry, less miserable, less self-destructive. I was at war with the world. More in just a moment. Stay tuned after this book selection. We're going to take a look at an unusual approach to therapy through role-playing games.
And now, a live reading from Rachel's Poetry Corner.
Elephants Theremin's Clifton, Neopets Porstrips Jepson, Pine Smell Jellybeans Goligoles, Skittles Squirrels and the Mole, Celery Chopsticks Pumpernickel, A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, Lullabies Tie-Dye The More You Know, all of these things on our wonderful show.
All these things and more wait for you on Wonderful, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
We're back with me, John Moe, and I'm reading to you from my book, The Hilarious World of Depression. I've just had a road rage incident. I've gone home and wondered whether the cops were going to come to my house. The cops didn't come that day, or any day after that. Encounters with other human beings continue to be problematic, as my touchiness around the kids led to plenty of smothered eruptions on my part around the house. I kept it bottled up until everyone in the house might have preferred I yell. Calls and emails from friends, invitations to participate in things, went unreturned. In this pre-Facebook world, you had to work to keep in touch with friends, and I was not up to that work. Because I made no effort, many of those people surely felt that I simply didn't like them or care about them. And it wasn't the case. I loved those people. I loved my friends. Thing was, I didn't want them to see me like this. No fun, grouchy, a failure, a wretch. I didn't want to see myself reflected back from them as they realized what I was becoming and responded with pity or revulsion. Of note, that's not how it really would have gone at all. My friends, being friends, wanted to see me in good times or bad because that's what friendship is. A depressed mind is pretty adept at buying into a distorted reality. Any door that could be closed to the world, I started pushing shut. If an encounter with another person was going well, depression told me that meant it would be a steeper drop when things fell apart, which was bound to happen. If I perceived the encounter would be bumpy or there would be conflict, all the more reason to avoid it entirely, since I knew I lacked the self-esteem and confidence to resolve it amicably. There were a few exceptions to my misanthropy, though. I loved my wife and kids. When we'd take a stroll to get an ice cream or a burrito, maybe swing by the pet store, things were great. Yes, having young kids is stressful, but the torrents of love they provided and that I gave back to them made me feel more grounded and positive about the world. I worried, I was exhausted, but it all felt good because it was for these fantastic humans. Jill and I were always on the same wavelength of celebrating the weirdness of our little family and the weirdness endemic to families in general. When Charlie turned 3, we had a large appliance cardboard box-themed party, with boxes gathered from the local appliance store. This was, instead of my proposed party theme, choking hazards. All these things around the house that said, not for children 3 or younger. I figured we'd get a bunch of marbles, small Legos, jacks, whatever we could find, and then celebrate being able to play with them, like when someone turns 21 and you take them to the bar. The extended family was another matter. I'll back up a few years. On the day after my father retired, in June of 1998, 6 of us went to see a live taping of A Prairie Home Companion in Redmond, Washington. Mom and Dad, my sister Lisbeth, her husband Marg, Jill, and me. Immediately after the show was over, Dad started coughing horribly due to side effects of what we soon learned was cancer. He went through treatment, but the cancer kept progressing steadily over the next year and a half. Dad didn't necessarily welcome cancer, but made no vow to defeat it either, just accepted that his ride was here and it was time to go, which in August of 1999, he did. All 4 kids had gathered at the house, my brother Rick coming up from San Diego, and my sister Medlina having flown in from Norway with her kids for what they thought was a vacation. Rick was sleeping some 20 hours a day in his old bedroom, either on drugs or coming off them. His chief concern during his few waking hours was the continued operation of the mail services. "Has the mail come yet? What time does the mail get here?" he would ask. In an envelope from UPS or FedEx or the actual U.S. Postal Service, he said, would be a check that he'd been waiting for. But we all knew the substance inside said envelope would not be paper. At the end, we were all sleeping at the house, and Erling Moe, my father, died overnight, not wanting to make a big deal out of it. After finally waking up and hearing about his father's death, Rick's first words were, "Has the mail been here?" I know that addiction is an illness, and that Rick was being controlled not by free will, but by intoxicants. If I heard about a non-relative struggling with substance use, I would have tremendous sympathy and kindness in my heart. But not with Rick. I was furious that Rick had been swallowed up, that he had turned into my dad. Addiction had done something more sinister than merely killing my father. It controlled his actions and blunted his free will. Addiction played with my dad and brother like marionettes. There were so many memories I had of trying to connect with a father who appeared to be standing in front of me, but who wasn't really there. If you have an alcoholic parent, you build a little fortress around yourself. You don't trust people to be looking out for you, and you gather such vivid memories of being let down that you reduce or sever relationships. So the risk of disappointment is eliminated. You are a rock. You are an island. If you're depressed on top of that, and you probably are, you build those walls thicker, stronger, and higher because being let down is the only feasible outcome of a relationship. You can't relax into a friendship. You can't really believe that someone will do the thing they're supposed to do. The parent is the first person you learn to rely on, and when your parent proves unreliable, well, that means everyone's unreliable. We had my dad cremated, as per his wishes. Actually, his wishes were that we make absolutely sure he was dead and only then cremate him. We made sure to do so, which was both grim and kind of amusing. Then we chartered a boat to scatter his ashes in Puget Sound. A few years after the dump freakout, Dad still dead and gradually dissipating in Puget Sound, Mom called to say Rick was coming up to visit. This always meant that she had bought him a ticket, and he would generally show up without luggage of any kind, maybe a nylon gym bag. By this point, she had sold the house in Federal Way and moved up to Seattle, where both Lisbon and I lived. Mom asked when we would like to come out to her house because she claimed Rick really wanted to see me, Jill, and the kids. Any decision I make, I thought, must be focused on what is best for my immediate family. Rick was my brother, but he also had an unknown relationship to methamphetamine, which could make someone unpredictable and violent. Jill and I talked about this possibility of visiting with Rick, and finally, I thought about what we'd do if the cast of characters was different. What if this was happening not with my family, but with my friend Andy? If Andy Jensen called, I said, and he invited us over, and he said his friend is going to be there, and his friend really wants to meet us and our kids, and he said that his friend has had drug addiction issues for years, and last we heard he was doing meth, would we go over to Andy Jensen's house? No, we wouldn't. We're not going to come see Rick, I told Mom on the phone. I need to think of my kids first, and I just don't trust that he's clean. I can't take any risks. She was stunned. I had to restate it a few times. Finally, she said, I think he's doing much better. I don't think he's doing drugs anymore. I hope you're right, I said, but I don't have that confidence and I don't want my kids around him. Laying down the boundary felt both right and wrong. Right because it was healthy and proper and logical. Wrong because I was turning my back on my family of origin. But it felt more right than wrong. One thing I didn't bother hoping for was that my refusal to see Rick would get back to him and cause a change in behavior. I had spent a childhood, the only one I got, believing that if Dad saw how unhappy his smoking and drinking made me, he'd snap out of the substance's grasp and make a healthy decision. With new boundaries designed to keep the people out, my world was getting awful damn small. And still I looked for other things I could toss out to make that world yet smaller. There was my job, which happened to be about the coolest job imaginable, from being a junior-level public radio producer at KUOW, Seattle's NPR affiliate, I had worked my way up to delivering newscasts and then hosting shows. KUOW was often the number one station in Seattle, a city teeming with brainy, thoughtful people who love their public radio. I was producing and hosting a weekly business and tech show. I went out and toured businesses like potato chip factories and prosthetic limb companies, and I was trusted to make the kind of show I wanted. I pitched in here and there for the arts show, which meant that people like David Sedaris would come in to be interviewed by me, or the Indigo Girls would come in and perform for a broadcast audience of millions, but a live audience of precisely just me. I had the greatest job anyone I knew could imagine. My boss believed in me, audiences liked me, coworkers thought highly of my work, and most of them enjoyed my company. I had job security to stay there forever. Obviously, I had to get the fuck out of that place. Here's what that situation looks like to someone with increasingly severe undiagnosed depression. The show I made was on the air once a week on a Tuesday night, where there were fewer listeners than if it was on during the day. That meant, to me, that the station hated me and thought I was stupid. I pitched in on the arts show, but I wasn't hosting it, meaning that I was either being carefully screwed over by management or spitefully shunned by colleagues. I also didn't make as much money as I wanted and was pissy about that, even though I knew the station's firm salary scale was mandated by the University of Washington, with which the station was affiliated. Oh, I could do stories for national shows in the public radio system for extra money, and I did, but still I railed against the inherent injustice of it all. Depressed people have an urge to make good things into ugly messes to better match their state of mind. Of course, the career malaise was not a cause of my mounting misery, it was a symptom. The cause was depression, a condition I continued to incorrectly associate only with sadness and moping. I didn't feel like sitting in a room and frowning. I could get out of bed easily. Two young kids were glad to help with that. So therefore, I could not be depressed. I'm worried about you, Jill said one evening, having prepared her words carefully. You seem to be doing worse and worse, and I don't think it needs to be this way. I think you might be depressed, and I think you should go to the doctor. I want you to go to the doctor. Obviously, this was a ridiculous idea. I was grim and grouchy, sure, and of course I didn't want to be like that anymore. And naturally, I didn't like where my mood was going. But what Jill was failing to grasp, I told myself, was that the world was horrible, and thus my reactions were normal and reasonable. I mean, who was crazy here? My wife, who didn't see the grim reality, or me, who knew everything was doomed and dying? Thanks, I said. I'm just going through a stressful time. My job is hard. My commute is hard. We have two young kids. It's hard, but it'll get better, I said. I smiled, hoping that would fool her. It wasn't going to get better, and I knew that, but why drag her down with me? There was another reason, too, to not go to the doctor. One I didn't tell her, and this will make perfect sense to people who have dealt with depression and make absolutely no sense to people who never have. I didn't want to waste the doctor's time. I knew for a fact that I could not be helped, so let that appointment go to someone with solvable problems. Reader, the whole point of a doctor is to know more than you do, assess a problem, and then help you. Seeing people and trying to help them is the entirety of their job, and thus, if you are a person, you are worthy of being seen. You are worthy of help. I'm not going to a doctor, I said. I mean, what if they put me on pills and I become a zombie or something? Plus, it's a copay. Our copay at the time was $10. I was not worth $10. If you don't love yourself enough to go do this, do you at least love me and the kids? Jill asked. Oof. Yes. Okay, then do it for us. Swedish West Seattle Primary Care Clinic was located a half mile from the house we lived in at the time, a 10-minute walk, a 3-minute drive, on our insurance. My appointment was first thing in the morning. I dragged myself to the reception desk and checked in. And what is the problem? The receptionist asked. What? The problem you're having, the reason you're seeing a doctor today. My God, did she expect me to say it out loud in front of a lobby full of people, all of whom were sitting far enough away that they couldn't possibly hear me, but still? Mental health issues? I finally muttered, rolling my eyes to indicate that this was obviously someone else's overreaction and I just needed someone to tell me I was fine. She was nonplussed and typed it in. A nurse checked my vitals, ran me through some physical exam steps. Finally, Dr. Michael Kovar entered the exam room with a smile and handshake that I sheepishly returned, still embarrassed to hassle him with my complete lack of actual problems. He asked me about energy levels, low and dropping, sleep patterns, erratic at best, social habits, none, and whether I ever felt hopeless. Ha ha, yup. Well, you're depressed, he said. Major depressive disorder is the medical name. You're depressed. You have depression. Come on, I replied incredulously. How can you tell I'm depressed just by asking me a few questions? Oh, no, I knew it the second I saw you. The questions and stuff were to make sure, and to be polite. Well, good one, Kovar. He said I could try a bunch of things to address it, and he'd work with me on that. There isn't any one single thing that works for everyone, he said, but there are a lot of things that we can try. Right off the top, it's a good idea to get out and exercise on a regular basis. You don't need to train for a marathon, but set a schedule for running and biking. Eating healthy is always a good idea, too. And he said, I'd like to start you on some medication. We'll try the lowest dose of Zoloft just to see how it goes. Is there any way we could do this without pills? I asked. I don't want to be all altered. I want to still be myself. Well, this kind of medication doesn't make you into anyone else. If it works the way it does for a lot of people, you'll feel more like yourself. Kind of cleans the windshield. As for not being altered, well, how's the status quo working out for you? This Kovar character had a good answer for everything. Almost as if he had been in 1,000 conversations like this one and had years and years of medical training. He said looking into talk therapy would also be a good idea, that it helped a lot of people in my situation. But in the meantime, he wanted me to feel better much sooner, and thus the Zoloft. So, okay, things have been rougher lately, I admitted, since my dad died, really. That was in 99. But it just feels like a bit more of something that has been going on my whole life. Are you saying that this thing I've been feeling and dealing with my whole life is depression? Yes, he said without hesitation. I mean, probably. I don't know everything you've been through, but this is a really easy diagnosis for me to make. It's pretty textbook. You're kind of boring from a diagnostic point of view. I got in the Ape and started the drive to KUOW, trying to figure out what all this might mean and how I felt about it. The main thing I felt was great, happy, relieved. This thing had a name, this awful buzzing weight, this monster in the open closet, this ever-present cloud of thick smog. This was an illness, not a fundamental part of my character. I wasn't bad, I was sick. I'd grown up in a house with substance use issues, traumas, both inherited and generated, and a series of cultural beliefs that silenced any meaningful conversation or action to deal with them. I thought a strong undercurrent of pain and toxicity was just part of being in a family. Now, if I think it's normal, but it has always felt fundamentally bad, it's not really normal at all. It is a problem. The problem has a name. The problem's name is depression. I also thought this. Neat. If I could live without depression, that would, I imagine, be great. Even though I couldn't imagine how that would actually work. Would it be like being good looking? With this diagnosis of depression, I headed back out into the world, pledging to take my meds consistently and get to a therapist. That's from The Hilarious World of Depression, available now in paperback, wherever you get your books. Lots of other things happen in the book, some tragic, some revelatory, some kind of funny, and yeah, Bigfoot's in there as well. You know me. Just ahead, grab your quarterstaff, your gold coins, and your elixir of mental health, role-playing games, and therapy.
Did your neighbor back into your car?
Bring that case to Judge Judy.
Think the mailman might be the real father?
Give that one to Judge Mathis.
But does your mom want you to flush her ashes down the toilet at Disney World when she passes away?
Now that's my jurisdiction. Welcome to the court of Judge John Hodgman, where the people are real, the disputes are real, and the stakes are often unusual.
If I got arrested for dumping your ashes in the Jungle Cruise, it would be an honor.
I don't want to be part of somebody getting a super yacht.
I don't know at what point you want to go into this, but we've had a worm bin before.
Available free right now at MaximumFun.org.
Judge John Hodgman, the court of last resort when your wife won't stop pretending to be a cat and knocking the clean laundry over.
Mary Dvorak is a marriage and family therapist at Centier Psychotherapy in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
And I guess there's one more job title to add here, which is Dungeon Master also.
Yeah, Therapeutic Dungeon Master.
Tell me about this group you lead. Who's in it and what do you do?
So right now I have a group of high school students who are just interested in role-playing games and working on their mental health. And we play it weekly together, and I lead it in a safe but fun way where we can still work on mental health, but have fun playing a game.
And what's the actual campaign that you're on? What's the quest that you're guiding these people on?
The quest. We are doing the Critical Core, is what it's called. And the quest is taking all the kids into a fantasy land where we get to kill a bunch of skeletons and all of that. Yeah.
That's a good therapy analogy right there. Killing all your skeletons. What is Critical Core?
Critical Core is designed by some therapists and mental health professionals for the purpose of doing therapeutic gaming or gaming in therapy. It's specifically designed to work on things like emotional regulation and frustration tolerance.
And so how does that play out during the actual game?
So it's oftentimes not really obvious that it's happening. I like to let it happen organically. And it's so cool to watch because it does happen organically. But sometimes I will also ask them how they're feeling and describe why they made a certain choice.
And in Dungeons & Dragons, it's like you said, it's a role-playing game. So people who aren't as familiar with it, this isn't, you know, Bob Smith, the patient, being Bob Smith on a skeleton-smashing quest. They become other, not just people, but beings. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. So an important part of Dungeons & Dragons in the beginning is creating your character and building a backstory. So there are multiple types of characters. I call them races and classes. And so all of the kids have gotten to pick the ones that speak to them, like halflings. There's also human, tons of options.
Thief, magic user.
Yeah. So
I'm recalling these from about eighth grade. I don't think I've played much since.
Yeah, like druids.
Okay. And what do you find about the kind of characters that the teenagers select? Like, are they aspirational, or do they pump them up, or do they put them down, or what?
Oftentimes they just reflect their own personality. So some kids will design characters who are just really strong and just want to just annihilate everything. And mm-hmm. so they put all of their points into their strengths. Whereas others want to be more strategic and sneaky. And then other people like using magic and doing fun, creative things in that realm.
And then what is the therapeutic element of it? So, you know, I'm a halfling. I have an axe. I have a lot of charisma, let's say. How does this help me with stress or depression or anything like that?
Yeah, good question. So it allows kids to, and adults, actually. I don't know why I'm saying kids. It's all people. We can externalize our problems or our issues, whatever is going on. And we either consciously or unconsciously work through them. For example, I'll lead a family through a campaign, and kids are playing with their parents. And by the end, a kid is saying, wow, like, and this is verbatim, I should listen to you more. You make really good choices.
Oh, man.
To their parent. And it's like, what? And then another kid will lead what they called civilians through a meditation. And they'll just start to use these therapeutic skills, oftentimes without me even telling them to do that. It just comes naturally.
You were telling me when we spoke before about, I believe it was a girl who selected a monk as her character, and it had to do with how extroverted or introverted she was.
Yeah. So she didn't know a whole lot about the characters, and she chose the monk. So I told her monks don't have really high charismas usually, which means they might not be very nice to people. And she said, maybe she just doesn't know what to say.
Mm.
It was amazing because she just reframed it, and just knowing this person, she was completely reflecting her own experiences as she wanted to learn how to make friends. She just didn't know what to say.
You know, it's regular therapy doesn't often involve broadswords, but in many ways, this sounds like I'm hearing the goals of therapy in here. You know, there's a lot of therapy where you try to stand outside yourself just enough to kind of notice, oh, these are my tendencies. These are my cognitive distortions. This is the problematic behavior patterns that I get into. It's sort of just doing the same thing as some pretty fundamental therapy, even though it's in a completely new setting.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And it can be really funny to explain it to people, but it reflects those goals.
I mean, is there a value in therapy being made more fun?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there is, but is that Is that why you're seeing a lot of success in this program, you think? Because it's just the pressure's off?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. There are teenagers, imagine talking to a teenager who just doesn't want to be in therapy. So they just, you know, sit in the room silently. Engaging them in a game is a completely different experience. And some don't jump right in, but it pulls them in a different way and engages them in that process.
Okay. What are some of the big successes that you've seen? What are the ones that you go home and tell your wife about?
Yeah. Oh, so I love the character creation time, and I just see everyone putting pieces of themselves into their characters. Sometimes people do the exact opposite. So one person who created the character who led civilians through a meditation, he was really experiencing this compassion for others. And throughout the play, he started applying that to himself as well. It just brings tears to his individual therapist's eyes and mine, just because helping a 16, 17-year-old kid have compassion for themselves, like, it's amazing. It's those things that really just keep me going.
Well, Mary, good luck on your campaign. Avoid whatever the metaphor of what the dragon represents. Avoid that for your party that's out there. And keep up the good work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mary Dvorak is a marriage and family therapist in St. Paul. We have a link to learn more about the game Critical Core on our show page. Next time on Depression Mode, Hrishi wanted to write more songs, but there were these voices in his head telling him that he sucked really bad. And the thing about those voices is that they were very talented.
They're very smart and have such great reasoning. It's hard to really go against them. Hear all the reasons that they lay out for why I am a no-talent hack, and I'm like, I'm convinced.
Hrishikesh Hirway, creator and host of Song Exploder, joins us. If people support our show, we can have a show. We like having a show. Won't you have a show with us? It's easy to support Depression Mode. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join, select Depression Mode, find a level that works for you, and then look, hey, we're all making a show together. Be sure to hit subscribe on this podcast. Do it now and give us 5 stars and write glowing reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which lets us help more people. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988 or 1-800-273-8255. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Our Facebook group is the Preshies. Go search up Preshies on Facebook and join us. Lots of great discussions happening there. We're on Twitter @DepreshPod. Our newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMo. Hi, credits listeners. My book, The Hilarious World of Depression, was written while listening to the album Quadrophenia by The Who. Over and over and over again as I wrote. Listen for it, I guess. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now. Building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Marissa in Los Angeles, and I just wanted to remind you that you are worthy of love, you're worthy of rest, not because of how hard you're working or how much you're putting out into the world, but just because you are. You are.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MomFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.